Well, I hope you're enjoying tonight's discussion with Mike Kaiser as we talk about ancient astronauts and the possibilities of. We'll be back in a moment with more with Michael on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, they are theorizing that just in our galaxy alone, there could be billions and billions of Earth-like planets now. Remarkable story based on projections. What are your thoughts on that and the possibility that eventually on one of these planets, there's got to be some kind of intelligent life out there?
Well, this is going to sound like a contradiction, but I'm going to say it anyway. I don't put a whole lot of stock in the Drake equation that tries to beef up the mathematical odds. I sort of agree with Michael Crichton, who called the Drake equation meaningless, and that's because each point in the equation is nothing more than a guess. But here comes the contradiction. I still think it's possible. despite my pessimism is about the equation, I also don't think there's any reason it couldn't be. So I sort of look at it as in a I sure hope so. You know, it'd be kind of interesting. To me, well, it'd be more than kind of interesting. It'd be fascinating. You know, if we ever come across anything like that. So I'm optimistic, but not really for a mathematical reason. I think it's entirely within the realm of possibility.
So why do you think that, though?
Well, I think despite the fact that we don't actually have a way of determining the odds, you would think, that there would be at least one. I don't think there's billions and billions, again, because I just don't put any stock in the equation. But I have to think that potentially there's a couple of places, that could, actually sustain life. And I mean, who knows? Theologically, I don't have any reason to say that God, could not, have, had life elsewhere by whatever means. Ultimately with this question, you get into the creationism issue, is evolution false? Did God use evolution? All sorts of views of that, shoving that all to the side. I don't really care by what means. I think that God's big enough to do that. And yeah, it's a very old belief within the Judeo-Christian tradition. In the centuries ago, it used to be called the principle of plenitude, that if you said God couldn't have created life on other worlds, you were limiting the power of God. And I kind of feel that way. So I think there's got to be at least a couple out there. I think the law of averages at least works in that direction. I don't know, but I'm not, I sort of divorced myself from the equation because every point of it is a guess. And, people will admit that and, be optimistic anyway. And so I'm one of those, I think it's possible.
Well, the primordial soup is the same. And eventually, the mixture is going to be at the right kind of planet that is far enough away from its sun, its star. It could happen.
See, the way you put that is a reason why a lot of religious people don't want to believe in it, because it sounds random. It sounds like evolution. And I'm one that I think Genesis can be, the first three verses of Genesis can be interpreted in a lot of ways, that you'd have either a young Earth or a very, very, very ancient Earth and universe. I think that the text gives us a lot of latitude there, but that sort of, the way you frame that, that's the reason why a lot of Christians, push back on this. But again, I'm not one of those. I think by whatever means, whether it's by special creation, like on Earth, process of evolution, maybe that's, maybe God, did things that way. I mean, who knows? We're talking in hypotheticals, but on my sort of list, I put this as, boy, it would be wonderful in my lifetime to actually get an answer to this question. But I'm optimistic just because I think, I don't have any coherent reason to say that it can't be this way, even though I don't really put too much stock in the Drake equation.
Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the book of Genesis. I mean, you have studied this. You're a Hebrew scholar. Let's talk about this. Let's interpret it if we can. It fascinates me. What were these fallen angels, Michael?
Well, I think like Genesis 6 is what you're referring to, the sons of God.
Mm-hmm.
I do take what up until the 3rd or 4th century AD was the dominant view, was really the only view. I take it at face value that you do have divine beings, you know, coming to Earth, and there is some sort of, you know, cohabitation, interaction. I mean, there's a lot of ways to parse that, but I think we have supernatural beings that can assume physical form, can assume flesh. There's a lot in terms of the Old Testament that you could refer to there. God himself in Genesis 18, for example, Genesis 28, Genesis 32 shows up as a man embodied. And so if God can do it, I don't see any reason why lesser beings couldn't do it. Genesis 19, we have angels that, you know, are in physical form because they grab Lot, Abraham's nephew, and pull him into a house. And Genesis 18, they eat with God. Two of them are with God embodied, and they have a meal. So in my thinking, there's plenty of biblical precedent for the idea that a being that's who's by nature disembodied, a spiritual being, could assume physical form and do what physical form enables them to do. And I think that's what we have in Genesis 6. It is clearly cast as negative, as a rebellion, sort of a transgression of one realm to the other. But, you know, I do take it that way.
Well, but what about did you study the book of Revelation much?
Yeah, I have spent a good deal of time there, not as much as the Old Testament, but sure. That's one of those popular books. Everybody wants to the end of the book of Revelation. So we could talk about some parts of that, if you like.
Sure. In terms of the book of Revelation, the apocalypse, end times, is that going to happen?
Well, I do think... Yeah. End times is sort of one of my least favorite subjects.
Really? How come?
Well, on the one hand, it is fascinating, but on the other hand, it's so cryptic and it's so nebulous, it's so ambiguous. I just wish there was. I say that because I wish there was more clarity, like there is on a number of other things, a number of other passages. But yeah, I do think history is headed somewhere. I think that God does have a specific endpoint, specific end game in mind, and history is moving there, and there will be a second coming. There will be a final culmination. I think there will be a final conflict between good and evil, all those sorts of things. Yeah, the trick is what is Revelation actually describing? Because should we read it as a straight through linear story, or do we have scenes that repeat each other all the time? Those are two fundamentally different ways of looking at the book, and they're both possible, that you just have the same cycle of events just sort of winding up and repeating on themselves, as opposed to just a linear chronology. And boy, you know, depending on which view of that you take, you wind up at really dramatically different places in terms of how you think end times will play out and what it'll look like.
If it'll even play out.
Yeah, I mean, in both view, really, both views and really any view, there is an end point. There's a terminus, you know, that's the recreation. You know, after a cataclysm, there's the recreation of Earth, a new Earth that is sort of a global Eden, global Edenic state. So everybody pretty much agrees that it ends really badly, but then really good.
That's true.
You know,
after 1,000 years or something.
Yeah, once you get beyond that point, you know, there, as far as the details, there's a lot of disagreement.
I want you, Michael, because you are a scholar, you've looked at everything. Tell me what you think this all means. I mean, and I'm going to really go out on a limb here and ask you if you even believe there's a God.
Oh, I do believe there's a God.
You
I
do.
I think the point of all this is that God, I don't think there was any deficiency in God, that God, you know, created humans because he lacked something. I think God wanted beings who were like him. I think that's the point of all the imaging language, you know, creating humanity in our image and all that sort of thing. You know, we can get into the plurals, but to cut to the chase here, God wanted beings on this place that he created who would be him if he were here embodied, and to be like him, to fellowship with him, to rule with him, to be his family, so to speak. He had a spiritual family, you know, the sons of God, you know, unseen, disembodied beings who were his children, his family, who ran, you know, the cosmos with him. But when he created Earth, according to biblical theology, he wanted humans, embodied beings, to do that and actually to live together. If you notice in Genesis, the divine family and the human family are at the same place. Heaven meets Earth, and there's sort of a blended family and a blended rule. And in the biblical story, the fall ruins that. Immortality is lost, but then everything is sort of working back to that point. So I think the whole point of it is that God wants a family. He wants people to share in what he is for their enjoyment and for his. And the place where that is going to happen with them, with the human family, is here on planet Earth. So, you know, the whole story of the Bible, the Old and New Testament, is about God taking steps to undo the rebellion, both in terms of the divine beings, whether it's the so-called serpent in Genesis 3, the fallen angels in Genesis 6, or human beings. God is the one who takes it upon himself to fix that, because it's beyond human capability to do that. And that's what the gospel is in the Bible, that Christ is the central figure for doing that, to sacrificially die on the cross, to make that reversal possible. And humans who trust God, who believe in that plan, who put their faith in it and nothing else, that they can't earn their own deliverance. If they believe in Christ, then those are the ones who are going to live and rule and reign with him. So I think, you know, God wants us to be happy, and we make God happy, again, as his family, but we have to believe. You know, we have to put our faith in what he has decided to do. And I think that's sort of the simple, maybe simplistic way to look at the whole story. There's lots of details and lots of ups and downs and lots of tragedy and lots of violence and all those sorts of things in the biblical story. But in a nutshell, that's God's aim.
What is your belief over the forming of the planets, of the universe? God's input, purely scientific?
Well, I think that I do make a distinction between the creator and creation. There's only one uncreated being, that is God. Everything else is created, which would include the material universe. Now, this is actually, you actually get into something interesting here, because if God is the only uncreated being, if we have a firm creator-creation right. distinction, that means that even unseen beings are made of something. They can't be uncreated.
That's
they have
true.
They have to be derivative. They have to be contingent. They had to be created. And the Old Testament and the New Testament has God creating all things seen and unseen, visible and invisible, is the biblical terminology. So the Bible acknowledges that even the unseen world, those beings are made of something. They have to be, because only God is uncreated. So that brings up all sorts of interesting possibilities, because when you talk, I mean, you have plenty of guests on the show that talk about other dimensions, talk about, you know, quantum reality, things like this. These are all things that are unseen but yet are material. And so theologians actually like to live, you know, in that arena. This is why there are a lot of physicists. When I was in graduate school, where I went to church, we had three PhD physicists in there. Two of them were a married couple. But a lot of physicists are really interested in theology, and they believe in God. They believe, you know, in lots of these things, because they sort of see how it could work in conjunction with the material world. I think it's just kind of interesting. I'm no physicist, but I am interested in quantum physics and things like that. Stuff that you have on the show, I think, are really fascinating, because I think theological thoughts about them and it stretches me. And, you know, I try to sort of come up with ways that these things intersect, because I do believe they do intersect.
Do you believe in the possibility that whatever happens on this planet is predetermined, that it there's nothing we can do about it?
I think God's ends are predetermined. I do not think that all events are determined. Let me give you an instance why.
Okay.
There's an Old Testament story in 1 Samuel 23, if people want to look it up. King David is running from King Saul, which David usually spent most of his time running from Saul. Saul's trying to kill him. So he's holed up in a city, and the city's name is Keilah. And he hears...
And where is that city? Where is that?
That it's near Judea, in the southern kingdom of Canaan.
Okay.
So he's holed up in this city, and he hears that Saul finds out that he's in the city. Well, Saul's on his way to box him in, you know, so that he's trapped. And so what does David do? David says, hey, you know, we need to ask God what we should do. And so he, you know, the priest brings something called the ephod that they use to discern the will of God with. And he asks God, if Saul gets here and he surrounds the city, will the men of this city turn me over to Saul? And God says, right in the narrative, people can read it, God says, yep, they will turn you over in a heartbeat. And so what David does is says, well, I'm glad I found that out. I'm out of here. And he leaves. Now, what does the story tell us? It tells us that God foreknew something that didn't occur.
Right.
That means that the fact that God foreknows something does not necessitate that it's predestined to happen.
Because we have free will.
Right. I'm a believer that human beings must be truly free in terms of free will, because freedom is an attribute of God that God shares with us. If we are God's imagers, we must have freedom, because if we didn't, we could not be like him. You follow that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's really important. If we were to have our freedom removed, we would no longer be like God. We would no longer be in his image. He would undo what he did in creation, and God doesn't do that. So, you know, he lets humanity be free. So we have all sorts of, you know, free actions here, but God is big enough that he can allow human freedom, but through human influencers, through other divine beings, through a whole arrangement, a whole assortment of things that God has at his disposal to influence human behavior. He moves human history along. He moves each of our lives along toward the ends that he desires. And the message of the Bible, there are a number of passages like this, where God basically says, you know, you can do what you want, but I will have my way. I mean, I will get the job done. Things will end the way I want them to end. But he never steps in and strips away human freedom. And the fact that he knows all things real that will happen and possible, that tells us, you know, right off the bat, that the fact that God knows something doesn't mean it's predestined, because he can know things that don't happen. So, you know, I sort of take a backdoor approach to this whole free will and predestination thing. I think the ends are decreed, they're predestined. But the means to those ends, you know, God gives us genuine freedom. Now, he can jump in as he wants. I mean, there are different episodes in the Bible where he does that, where he jumps into human history, or he you know, causes something to happen to move something along. But then, you know, he pulls back and tries to influence, you know, through, you know, good examples, you know, a whole variety of means.
All right, Michael, when we come back, I want to talk with you about evil demons, your book, The Facade, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, as we've been talking about for several weeks now, the Coast to Coast merchandise store, we're having a blowout extravaganza. We put everything on sale, 25% off any order. When you go there, coasttocoastam.com, go all the way to the bottom, click the store link, and then when you get in there, whatever you want, put the coupon code C2C25, C2C25, and click activate, and that'll get you that discount. We're getting rid of all the older merchandise, the caps, drinkware, shirts, at a great deal for you. We're bringing in new material in another month or so. So go to coasttocoastam.com, click the store link at the bottom of the page. Michael, give us a recap of your book, The Facade, if you would.
Well, The Facade is sort of a matrix of all the things that I'm interested in. Ancient texts, the whole extraterrestrial question. And what happens in the book is you get several people sort of that wouldn't really belong together in on any other occasion that sort of get drafted unbeknownst to all of them into a situation where they are confronted with an extraterrestrial reality. And one of them, the main character, is essentially somebody like myself. One of them, his focus is not only biblical studies and theology, but also his specialty is something called the divine council, sort of the heavenly host and divine beings and gods and all that goes with that. And so he's confronted with this, what looks like an extraterrestrial reality. So the book takes the reader, it's a thriller, but in the midst of the action, you get a lot of really sort of, you know, heavy duty thinking about if this is real, how would we respond in terms of the major, you know, religions of the world and so on and so forth. So that's one part of it. But then he also is forced through a series of events to consider, well, maybe we're not really dealing with true extraterrestrials here. Maybe we're dealing with something like Jacques Vallée would call some sort of sinister intelligence, you know, some other kind of intelligence, a malevolent
messengers of deception.
Yeah, you know, something like that. And I really, you know, I don't really directly take anything from Vallée or John Keel, but it's that sort of thing. And I tie that into ancient texts with beings called the Watchers, who that's the Book of Enoch. That's Enoch's terminology for the sons of God. And there are different things in the Book of Enoch about what they may have looked like and shape shifting and stuff like that. So I tie a lot of ancient texts and things like that into it. So the sort of the shtick on the book is that everything in the book is actually real. Every text, every technology, every government document, everything is real. The fiction comes in the way that I connect all those dots and create the story to take the reader through, you know, big picture theological questions, religious questions, you know, questions about, you know, manuscripts and all sorts of things. So it's sort of this matrix of all the things that I'm sort of interested in.
Good for you. Multiverse.
Yeah.
If there's a God, of course I believe there is, but is he the creator of every universe, or is there a separate God for every universe?
My position is that he is the creator of all of them, especially if you have, you know, this whole idea of one universe sort of, for lack of a better term, burping another one into existence, you know, in this sort of, you know, succession string. It's sort of the same question of, well, if the universes or universe has this property that they can, you know, create other ones and so on and so forth, and we get this sort of endless loop, there has to be an intelligence behind that property, that ability. And a lot of these questions, you know, to me, just all they really do is sort of push back, you know, the ultimate question of who sort of kickstarted all this. And, you know, you don't have many options. Either there's an intelligence outside of that thing that made it, or it made itself, or you know, certainly we didn't. So you really only got, you know, two choices. It's either all, you know, sort of purely material and accidental, or there's a grand intelligence behind it. And I think it's just more coherent to go with the grand intelligence behind it, even if that intelligence uses natural processes like, you know, evolution or some sort of multiverse or, you know, string theory or all these things. Again, I don't have any, you know, difficulty because, you know, I'm fortunate. I know physicists, and I know physicists who are believers in God and physicists who are Christians, and they love this stuff. And so whenever I have a question, I can go to them. So I think it's really faith encouraging, these kinds of questions, rather than, you know, something that should be viewed as threatening. I don't consider them threatening at all.
What about evil? What about demons? Do they exist?
Yeah, I think because here we get in, believe it or not, we get into this plural language in Genesis.
Yes.
You get the statement in Genesis 1:26, let us create humankind in our image. Now, it's true that when the creation happens, according to Genesis, all the verbs are singular and you only have one deity doing the creation. But the our implies, and I would say really does more than that, I think it certifies that humans are like God. They image God, and one of the attributes God shares with them is freedom. Well, the plural suggests that God has also shared that attribute with the members of his heavenly host, these other divine beings. And so they have their realm where they represent God, the unseen world, and humans have this realm where we represent God. But that means we both have freedom to act. And so it's very reasonable, in fact, it's patently biblical, that divine beings have the same freedom we do to do good or evil. And so, you know, evil is the result of God's decision to allow his creatures, whether they be divine beings or humans, to allow them to act freely. You know, we can look at that and say, well, it wasn't that a risky decision on God's part. I mean, we're kind of suffering, you know, because of what happens there. And we are, but the alternative, I would submit, is worse. You know, if we couldn't act freely, if we were just robots, you know, I think that would be awful, because you can't even do something like love someone, you know, love God or a fellow man or anything like that, because it would have to be programmed into you. It would have to be predetermined. It's not a free act. You know, it doesn't cost you anything because you're programmed. And so I think God wanted his creatures to be like him. He wanted them to experience what it's like to be able to make these decisions, knowing that there's going to be a cost to this, but I'm going to take steps, you know, to rectify the situation. But he deemed the creation of, you know, of what we experience, both good and bad, preferable for our sake, you know, so that we can experience him and we can experience goodness as well, and love and some of these positive things. So yeah, I think that evil's real. I think that humans do evil. I think there are divine beings that are evil and act in evil ways. And, you know, I think the unseen world is a world of conflict. It's a world of spiritual conflict. You know, theologians like to throw around the term spiritual warfare. I think that's real.
Michael, you're a scholar. You're a biblical scholar. You're an expert in Hebrew texts as well. Do they talk about evil at any great length?
They talk about evil a lot. The fancy theological word for this is theodicy. You know, God's role, you know, in evil. In other words, why do we have, if God is good, why do we have evil, and so on and so forth. And that was sort of what I just ran through. So yeah, Scripture spends a good deal of time talking about evil, but frankly, it actually spends more time on God's efforts to rectify evil, to turn evil into good, and, you know, to work with humankind, you know, toward, again, the ultimate end of, you know, restoring Eden to earth, you know, sending Christ, pouring out his wrath on Christ. Christ is the central figure, you know, in all of this, because it took a divine act of power and a divine submission in biblical theology to suffer the effects of evil so that humans, you know, one day would not have to suffer those effects. And again, that's essentially what we call the gospel in a nutshell, to put our faith in what Christ did on the cross and to trust that this was God's program, God knows what he's doing, that God will, you know, will include us in an ultimate good ending to all of this. So it actually spends more time on God's effort to heal, an effort to rectify the situation, than it does, you know, just describing the wantonness of evil, even though you get that, but it's more positive than that.
Michael, the Vatican, the Catholic Church, has said that the belief in extraterrestrial life does not negate one's belief in God. Mm-hmm. What are they gearing us up for? Something?
Well, I think they're being cautious because, you know, the Catholic Church has actually had a long-standing interest in astronomy. I mean, even after the Galileo affair, what do they do? Well, they build an observatory. You know, I look at that situation, and I think what happened to Galileo in some respects was about, you know, control of information, that he sort of won up them, and they had to reassert some control in that. But they, very early after that, they were not hostile to the information of astronomy. It just took a while for them to sort of be public about it. I think they're being cautious that they suspect that at some point somebody's going to find something that really suggests, if not proves, that there's some kind of life out there elsewhere, and they're sort of laying the groundwork for a theological response. Now, on one hand, the church has been, you know, when I say the church, I mean just the organized, you know, Christian church, but it's true for Islam, it's true for Judaism. The theologians have been down this road and back for centuries, even millennia, have been thinking about the question of other worlds and viewing it actually positively. But that's the academy, you know, that's the priesthood, those are the scholars. So I think what they're doing here is they're sort of readying the public for some, you know, eventual event or response or some scientific finding that they can say, hey, look, you know, we've thought about this a long time, and they're going to progressively prepare the normal person, the laity, for how they've been thinking about that issue. And I think announcements like you're referring to are just part of that process.
I think so, too. Indeed. So as you look at all of this, Michael, over the years you've done this kind of work, is there anything that's going to bust loose that's going to get so many people to simply say, oh, my gosh, look what they're talking about. Look what's happening.
Well, I think despite, you know, somebody like me, and again, I'm not idiosyncratic in this way, and but I would say I'm sort of in a minority, at least, for people who have, I guess, for lack of a better term, what I would say a real conservative approach to theology. You get people in that camp. I think despite the fact that I could have a conversation with that person and say, look, you know, there's all sorts of theological reasons why you really don't need to worry about this, why the New Testament and the Old Testament has this base covered, it's still going to freak them out. And I think that you will have a lot of people that an extraterrestrial reality will be quite disturbing to them. I don't think it should. I don't think it has to, but I'm not naive enough to think that it won't. I think it really will. And actually in the facade, you know, the one of the main characters, you know, has to struggle with that issue. So I think it would freak a lot of people out. You know, it's unfortunate. Again, I don't think it has to, but I think it would.
I think it would too. Absolutely. So of everything you've studied in your career, everything, is there one area that still perplex you the most?
Oh, lots of things perplex me. Boy, that's really a good question. If I had to pick one.
What one question would you like to get the answer for?
Oh, I would like to know, you know, about, you know, if there is, you know, life elsewhere, that's a big one. Sort of the nature of creation. I am really interested in, again, I'm not a physicist. I couldn't wax eloquent on quantum physics, but sort of the nature of reality, how it works, you know, how time and space works like that. But, you know, those questions are so big, you know, even if, you know, I was, you know, confronted, you know, with the actual answer to that, I probably couldn't digest it anyway. But I guess if I had a wish list, it would be a question like that.
Recently, there was a discovery of some ancient texts that you know about on lead plates. Can you explain that?
Yeah, that actually made it's been sort of making waves in the blogosphere on the internet for quite a while. There was a claim that there were early Christian texts discovered in Jordan that were on lead plates. And I think you actually did a show on this a little while ago. When that happened, especially when the report was initially made, there was the initial find, and then people who were either associated with it or claimed to be associated with it started giving interviews and started giving conflicting stories. The fact that there were discrepancies and the fact that it was just ancient stuff led a lot of people in biblical studies and in archaeology who blogged to just really latch onto that. And the result of that is there's actually been a lot of good work showing in very concrete ways that these texts are more than likely, if not all of them, most of them are hoaxes. If your listeners are interested in this, on my front page, it's just drmsh.com, I have a link to the lead codices. It's a really nice site where you can get some animation videos where the guys who put this together, I actually know a couple of them, but they do some like flash, you know, video and some good special effects for the web showing how the texts were reproduced, you know, known texts in some manuscript were actually superimposed on lead plates and so on and so forth. It's really kind of fascinating. So on the one hand, I would say, hey, it's really, really cool and interesting how this was done. But on the other hand, I wouldn't put any stock in it as far as it being authentic. Have you ever read or seen it was made into a TV movie, the Irving Wallace book called The Word?
Yes.
Okay, that when I heard about this, I thought, This is going to turn out to be Irving Wallace, because the lead is probably going to date to the first century, and there are conflicting reports, but some of the tests have them that old. But I thought somebody's going to get these plates and they're going to reproduce, they're going to fake text, but the material will be authentic, and it's going to cause, you know, a big fear. And sure enough, a lot of the testing has borne that out. But I think that's what you have. You have some really clever people who had access to genuine material, but what they put on the material came from other sources that were already known, and, you know, trying to pull a fast one.
Michael, did you ever directly talk to Zechariah Sitchin when he was alive?
I never did. I've talked with his webmaster several times. I actually met his name's Eric. I actually met Eric in California a few years ago. But I've never met Zechariah Sitchin himself.
It would have been fascinating to see you two together.
I would have liked to have met him. I think it would have been, you know, I'm obviously we're going to disagree on some things, but I think it would have been even fun. I mean,
I would have liked for him to take you aside and say, "Here, Michael, this is where I see it," and have you say yes or no. You know,
well,
obviously.
I'd still like somebody to do that. Huh. You know, again, that's my.
But at least he knows where they were, right?
Well, what we have is what he wrote.
How did he have access to them?
Well, I see that to me, that's the question. I mean, if he's quoting these texts, and, you know, you go back and look at the primary text. I mean, what I think he's doing is I think he's sort of. On the one hand, you can't look at the text.
Hold your thoughts, Michael. We'll come right back and talk about it. Plus, we've got an hour of phone calls to go now. So those of you who have been calling since 2.5 hours ago, you can start it up right now.